Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today we're reading from the November 3rd, 2023 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week shows one of the Iranian ayatollahs. I don't remember his name, but the familiar garb, large beard, turban, glasses. He's holding a map of the Middle East in his right hand. In his left hand, he's got a lighter. And you can see that he is starting to burn the map of the Middle East. There's a fire going in Gaza, there's a fire near Lebanon, and then the whole side of the map is starting to go up in flames. The headline is Fueling the Fire. Will Iran turn the Israel-Hamas war into a regional inferno and draw in the U.S.? That is our first main story. We will start right there. U.S. worries Gaza war could spread across Mideast. What happened? Fears were rising this week that the Israel-Hamas war could escalate into a wider Middle East conflict after Iran-backed militias launched a wave of attacks on U.S. forces and Tehran warned of regional mayhem if Israel continues its strikes on Gaza. At least 24 American troops in Iraq and Syria have been wounded in at least 13 drone and rocket attacks since October 17th, the Pentagon said. And a U.S. destroyer last week shot down multiple missiles and drones fired toward Israel by Yemen's Iran-backed Houthi militia. While there was no evidence Iran had directly ordered the attacks on American forces, a U.S. official said the road leads back to Iran. Clashes between the Israeli military and the Iran-backed Hezbollah militants have intensified along the Lebanon-Israel border. And Syria, a key ally of Iran and Hezbollah, accused Israel of repeatedly striking airports in Damascus and Aleppo. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian warned that the region will go out of control unless the U.S. and its proxy Israel halt the offensive against Gaza-based Hamas. With signs of a humanitarian crisis mounting in Gaza, Israel began allowing limited deliveries of food, water, and medicine to the Palestinian territory through the Egyptian border. But it's a mere drop in the ocean of what is needed, said a United Nations official. More than half of Gaza's 2.3 million people are homeless. Many lack food and clean water, and more than 6,500 have been killed by Israeli strikes, according to health authorities in Gaza. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres accused Israel of clear violations of international humanitarian law and called for a ceasefire. Hamas released four of the hostages it seized during its October 7th attack on Israel, including two Americans. The terrorist group is holding some 200 other captives. Media reports said the Biden administration had asked Israel to delay a ground invasion of Gaza to allow more time for hostage negotiations and for aid shipments. But Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant indicated an invasion of the Hamas-controlled territory was imminent during a visit to troops at the border. You see Gaza now from a distance, he said. You will soon see it from inside. What the editorial said. The White House is rightly worried that the fire raging in Gaza could spread, said the Wall Street Journal. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has tried to discourage Tehran from taking advantage of the chaos by declaring that the U.S. will respond swiftly and decisively to any attack on American troops. But President Biden has failed so far to strike back at the Iranian proxies lobbing rockets and drones at our forces in Iraq and Syria. The longer we tolerate this aggression, the more likely that Iran will raise the stakes. Biden must play his best inside game to keep this conflict from widening, said the Boston Globe. He sounded many of the right notes, showing firm support for Israel while urging compassion for Gazan civilians. But ahead lies a slow, grinding, agonizingly bloody ground war that will cost untold Palestinian lives, inflame the region, and radicalize a new generation of young Palestinians. Vengeance might be served, but will Israel truly have become more secure? What the columnist said. The destructive toll of an Israeli ground invasion of Gaza will be staggering, said Damian Cave in the New York Times. Experts say Israeli troops entering densely packed areas could face some of the fiercest street-to-street combat since World War II. They'll encounter heavy fire from rooftops and booby-trapped apartments, drone attacks, and fighters indistinguishable from civilians who launch guerrilla attacks and then retreat underground to a maze of tunnels stocked with enough ammunition, food, and water to sustain a long war. Sparks are flying on numerous fronts that could spiral into a larger regional war, said Nahal Tusi in Politico. Besides the Israeli-Lebanon border, other potential flashpoints include Iraq and Syria, where defense officials are worried that recent small-scale assaults could worsen. There's concern such attacks could expand to target U.S. personnel from Bahrain to the United Arab Emirates. Meanwhile, violence is intensifying in the West Bank, where dozens of Palestinians have been killed by Israeli troops, and Palestinian authorities say at least five have been killed by settlers who may be taking advantage of the moment to sow fear in Palestinian communities. Despite their bellicose rhetoric, neither Iran nor Hezbollah want an escalation of war, said Lena Khatib in The Guardian. While this might seem a prime moment for Hezbollah to make a move, it must answer to the Lebanese public. And Lebanon, in the midst of a dire financial crisis, cannot withstand the cost of another war. And the last thing Iran wants is to elevate the conflict to the point where the U.S. intervenes, which could lead the war to spread to Iran itself. I have never been more worried about how this situation could spin out of control, said Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. The expanding attacks on U.S. forces suggest that Iran sees how much an ill-advised Israeli invasion of Gaza could help their goal of driving America out of the whole region. And Israel won't let Iran-backed militias strike its territory without eventually firing a missile directly at Tehran. If that happens, chaos could ensue, and the U.S., Russia, and China could all be drawn in directly or indirectly. The threat is real, and the hour is late. Controversy of the week. House GOP. Is its internal chaos a threat to democracy? Republicans have spent years perfecting their dysfunction, said Jason Linkins in The New Republic, and we're witnessing the spectacular results. While the White House GOP has now finally settled on Representative Mike Johnson as Speaker, the past 3 weeks of infighting have made it clear that a majority of Republican lawmakers have lost all interest in performing the basic functions of a majority party in the legislature. The Middle East is on fire. Ukraine is running out of weapons. The U.S. government is due to shut down on November 17th. Yet for 22 days, the House GOP caucus was locked in back rooms, eating pizza and arguing over which of the extremists in its midst should attempt the impossible job of trying to manage this warring gang of freaks. The old metaphor of the circular firing squad would be appropriate, said Jackie Calmes in the Los Angeles Times, if the specter of real violence hadn't entered the picture. Moderate Republicans who opposed a bid for the speakership by Representative Jim Jordan, an enthusiastic supporter of former President Trump's attempt to overturn the 2020 election, were bombarded with profanity-filled death threats from livid MAGA voters. The wife of Representative Don Bacon of Nebraska started sleeping with a loaded gun after receiving menacing calls and texts. Representative Drew Ferguson of Georgia had a sheriff assigned to his daughter's school. Those threats backfired, though, and the far-right Jordan lost, said Gabriel T. Rubin in the Wall Street Journal. In fact, the intimidation tactics seemed to stiffen the spines of anti-Jordan Republican moderates who are now wearing their independence from the MAGA bullies as a badge of honor. These chaotic weeks could end up being a turning point for the GOP, said E.J. Dionne in the Washington Post. The thuggish intransigence of Trumpist crazies like Representative Matt Gaetz, who ousted former Speaker Kevin McCarthy for working with Democrats on a spending bill, may have helped the party's moderates understand the need to confront extremism in their own ranks. If only for their own survival, they need to disown the MAGA fringe and cooperate, yes, with Democrats if necessary, in keeping the nihilist right from the levers of power. Dream on, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. The disorder in the House GOP is not a glitch that can be fixed by straight talk from swing district moderates. The House is a mess because enough Republican voters want it to be a mess. These voters have completely internalized the cynicism of Trump, and they see no connection between national politics and the health and security of the U.S. They want show trials and passion plays, not determined legislators with complicated plans. That stuff is just so boring. That's why they elect entertaining, aspiring authoritarians such as Jordan and Gaetz, who reliably liven up the Fox primetime hours by sowing chaos and endless conflict. The extremists haven't won yet, said Jonathan Martin in Politico. GOP moderates may be outnumbered in the House, but they are well represented in Mitch McConnell's Senate caucus. And let's not forget there's a whole Democratic Party whose voters outnumber Republicans, standing in the way of authoritarianism. That threat is real, but there are still enough antibodies resisting the virus. For now, said Ronald Brownstein in The Atlantic, but there's no way to sugarcoat the ominous reality that for the first time since the Civil War, the dominant faction in one of America's two major parties is no longer committed to the principle of democracy. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for contentment after Bella, a 14-year-old British cat, was awarded the Guinness World Record for loudest purr, which, at 54.59 decibels, is equivalent to the noise from a boiling kettle. She's like a giant white noise machine, said owner Nicole Spink. It was a good week for confidence after former President Donald Trump, who lost to Joe Biden in 2020, assured supporters in New Hampshire that his margin of victory in 2024 will be so huge that they needn't vote. Don't worry about voting, Trump said. We got plenty of votes. It was a good week for sightseeing after a train carrying hundreds of lawmakers to the European Parliament in Strasbourg took a wrong turn and ended up at Disneyland Paris. We couldn't get out, sadly, said an official, adding that he could see the top of Space Mountain during the pit stop. But it was a bad week for bad taste, with reports that the heirs of the late Italian Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, had no idea what to do with this huge collection of terrible art. His 25,000 paintings have an estimated average value of $800. Berlusconi bought many from late-night TV auctions. It was a bad week for Prance after Charles Mister Jr., a school board candidate in Everett, Washington, released an air-filled pledge vowing to make our children's future my priority. What's needed, he wrote, is quality learning environments, misspelled, where decisions are made by teachers and parents. Also misspelled, I think that's supposed to be teachers and parents. Anyway, finally, it was a bad week for Mississippi, which is the most stressed out state in the union, according to the American Psychological Association. Offsetting the lowest cost of living in the nation, Mississippi has the highest burden of money-related stress and the lowest average credit score. Short and other news piece on this page. Cohen testifies against Trump in New York fraud trial. Donald Trump's former lawyer, Michael Cohen, testified in a Manhattan court this week that he was told to reverse engineer the value of his former boss' real estate properties to match whatever number Mr. Trump told us. The star witness in New York Attorney General Letitia James' $250 million civil fraud case against Trump, Cohen said Trump would tell him, "I'm actually not worth $4.5 billion. I'm really worth more like $6 billion." James argues Trump, who glared at Cohen from across the courtroom, manipulated valuations to secure more favorable terms from banks. Trump's attorney challenged the credibility of Cohen, who served a prison sentence for federal tax evasion and campaign finance crimes tied to hush money payments to Stormy Daniels, Trump's alleged ex-mistress. Briefing this week is titled "The Surge in Child Labor." A growing number of companies in the U.S. are illegally hiring children and putting them to work in dangerous jobs. How many children work illegally? The exact number is not known, but officials have recorded a sharp rise in child labor law violations. Over the past fiscal year, Labor Department inspectors found 5,792 children working illegally, up 50% over the prior year and 470% since 2015, and levied more than $8 million in fines against employers. Many of these children are migrants fleeing poverty and violence in Central America, and many are engaged in dangerous work. This summer, at least three 16-year-olds were killed in industrial accidents. One became entangled in a conveyor belt at a Mississippi poultry plant. Another was caught in machinery at a Wisconsin sawmill. Another crushed between a semi-truck and a trailer at a Missouri landfill. In February, a Wisconsin-based company was fined $1.5 million for employing more than 100 kids ages 13 to 17 at a meat packing plant across the U.S., where they cleaned bone saws, head splitters, and other gear with caustic chemicals. Regulators have also found 10-year-olds working late shifts at McDonald's and an 11-year-old operating a forklift in a Kentucky warehouse. Jose Vasquez, a 13-year-old migrant, told the New York Times that he works 12-hour shifts, 6 days a week, at a Michigan egg farm. "I'd like to go to school," he explained, "but how then would I pay rent?" Why are more kids working? Two primary forces are at play: a shortage of adult workers and a spike in migrant child arrivals. More than 250,000 unaccompanied minors have entered the U.S. over the past 2 years. Since 2008, federal law has let migrant children live with sponsors while their cases wind through the immigration system, a policy designed to stop desperate kids being left alone in Mexican border towns. But critics say that because officials are under pressure to release children from federal custody, many are handed over to sponsors who exploit their young charges by making them work long hours. Many of these children also owe large sums to smugglers. Still more are under pressure to send money back home. It's not that we want to be working these jobs, said Kevin Thomas, who at 13 worked overnight shifts for an auto parts manufacturer in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's that we have to help our families. What does the law say? The Fair Labor Standards Act, signed in 1938 by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, set the minimum age for most employment at 14. It also bars children under 16 from working more than 3 hours or after 7 p.m. on school days, and prohibits anyone under 18 from working dangerous jobs, such as mining and manufacturing. But with lax enforcement by overstretched regulators and fines that max out around $15,000 per child, some firms have decided there's little risk to hiring minors. Children have even been found working for American companies linked to some top consumer brands. What jobs were those children doing? A Reuters investigation found children as young as 12 working for Alabama firms supplying auto parts to Hyundai and Kia. The New York Times reported on children making clothing for J. Crew, deboning chicken sold at Whole Foods, and packing Cheerios. Sometimes I get tired and feel sick, said Carolina Yock, a 15-year-old from Guatemala, who works 8-hour shifts at a Michigan cereal plant. But I'm getting used to it. The child workers are supplied by third-party employers, absolving the big-name companies from direct responsibility. Meanwhile, staffing agencies are being pushed to fill grueling jobs that few adult Americans would want. Some agencies turn a blind eye when youngsters present fake identification. Hyundai wouldn't want to ever directly hire children, said David Weil, a former top federal labor official. But when you set up a system like that, and then you go into a labor supply shortage, you get this kind of outcome. Are officials cracking down on employers? After the Times published its report in February, the Labor and Health and Human Services Department launched a joint task force to investigate and prosecute violations. The Biden administration has vowed to better vet the sponsors migrant children are released to and monitor children after they leave federal custody. And Democrats in Congress have introduced bills that would stiffen penalties for employers who violate labor laws. But amid federal clampdown efforts, some states are trying to make it easier for companies to hire under-18s. How many states are softening regulations? Over the past 2 years, at least 16 states, most of them GOP-led, have proposed or enacted laws that roll back child labor protections, according to the Pro-Union Economic Policy Institute. A law passed in Iowa in May allows children as young as 14 to do certain tasks in industrial laundries and meat coolers, and 16 and 17-year-olds to work in roofing, excavation, and demolition. Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders in March signed a law ending requirements for 14 and 15-year-olds to get state permits to work and have their ages verified. Proponents of such laws say we should enable teens who want to work at a time when employers desperately need them. The Iowa law will allow young adults to develop their skills in the workforce, said Governor Kim Reynolds. But critics say such measures open the door to further exploitation. They make it easier to illegally hire children, said Seema Nanda, the Labor Department's chief legal officer. No child should be working in dangerous workplaces in this country. full stop. Time for a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S., starting with free speech even includes anti-Semitism. Free speech protections apply to even the most morally repugnant views, said Nadine Strossen and Pamela Paresky. Yes, it was sickening to see university students and professors celebrating Hamas October 7th. Savage massacre, rape, torture, and kidnapping of 1,400 people in Israel. One Cornell history professor called its actions exhilarating and energizing. And at the University of Washington, pro-Hamas students chanted, "There is only one solution." Still, as Jews and as free speech advocates, we believe that as painful as it is to hear speech that calls for our elimination, we must resist the impulse to silence it. Senator Tom Cotton has demanded that the government deport foreign nationals from making pro-Hamas statements, but that would be blatantly unconstitutional. Courts have repeatedly ruled that the First Amendment protects hateful speech by anyone on U.S. soil unless it directly causes specific harm. Private citizens and companies, of course, are free to withhold donations to universities that have hosted pro-Hamas demonstrations, and to refuse to hire students who applauded terrorism. But silencing and blacklisting people will not change minds or make life safer for our fellow Jews. Dialogue is better at defeating cruelty than silence. What voters don't know is a lot. It is not polite to say so, but most voters are disconnected from reality, said Jonathan B. Last. In a recent Bulwark organized focus group of swing voters, most parroted right-wing criticisms of President Biden that completely conflict with the factual evidence. One voter complained that our economy is in the dumpster due to Biden's socialism. In reality, unemployment is down to 3.8%. Average wage gains of 4% are outpacing inflation, and the Dow is at 33,000, 14% higher than at any point in the Trump's presidency. Median household wealth is up 37% since Trump left office. And as for socialism, Trump raised the national debt by a record $7.4 trillion in just 4 years, a leap of more than 33%. One female voter conceded that Trump was a nut, but said he didn't leave the country in the shape that Joe Biden is leaving us in. Hello? Trump left office with the unemployment rate at 6.3%, the economy in free fall, and more than 90,000 Americans dying of COVID every month, and with no real plan in place to distribute vaccines. When people are this misinformed, it's no wonder Trump still has a chance to regain the presidency. This column comes from Brazil. The Amazon is parched and dying. What is happening in the Amazon is frightening and unimaginable, said Correio Brasiliense in an editorial. As Brazil's hottest, driest winter on record gives way to a scorching springtime, rivers that should nourish the world's largest rainforest have become little more than muddy streams, so shallow that boats run aground. Local indigenous villages, which rely on rivers for transport, are stranded without food and medicine, and their people must walk miles to find drinking water. In the Amazonian city of Manaus, the air is unbreathable because of a blanket of thick smoke from fires that were illegally lit to clear forest lands for farming and mining. Nobody can go out. The city has had to cancel school and university classes and even postpone the marathon. Climate change is to blame, of course, but the effects of global warming have been worsened by the federal government's failure to crack down on miners and ranchers. Without sustainable development alternatives based on the economic potential of the forest and its people, Arizona State Governor Wilson Lama said last week, we will not be able to protect either the forest, threatened by chainsaws, or the people, threatened by poverty and extreme weather events. And we're at the last word, our feature article. Title this week is Patrolling a Broken City. Surging rates of homelessness, overdoses, and violent crime are overwhelming first responders in Portland, Oregon, said Eli Saslow in the New York Times. Private security guards are filling the void. Michael Bach was still on his way into work for his shift as a private security guard when he came upon his first emergency of the day. He drove into downtown Portland, Oregon, a little after 6 a.m. and saw a man swinging a hatchet and chasing someone into the street. Bach, 46, pulled over and rolled down his window. "Security," he yelled. "Can we please settle down?" "He put his hands on my drugs," the man with the hatchet shouted. "I'm going to kill him." He jabbed his weapon in the air as the person he was chasing picked up a rock. Bach watched them circle each other and dialed 911. "A call taker will be with you as soon as possible," the recording said. And he waited on hold as he steered his car farther into the street, wedging it between the two men, honking his horn and sending them off in opposite directions as a dispatcher answered the line. "We had two transients in a street fight, but it looks like they're dispersing," Bach said. "All clear?" the dispatcher asked. "I guess so," Bach said, "for now." He continued driving into one of the many American downtowns where one crisis now spirals into the next, as spiking rates of homelessness, drug overdoses, violent crime and psychosis threaten to overwhelm the public safety infrastructure. In Portland, a record-breaking number of daily emergencies has strained every part of the system. 911 hold times have quintupled since 2019. The average police response has slowed to nearly an hour. Firefighters work overtime to handle more overdoses than actual fires. And each week, there are no ambulances left to respond to hundreds of medical emergencies. What has arrived into the void are thousands of private security guards hired by office buildings, coffee shops, stores, schools, and parking lots in what has become one of the country's fastest growing industries, with annual revenue exceeding $40 billion. Most major U.S. cities now have at least three times as many security guards on the street as sworn police officers. Even though guards typically operate with minimal oversight, less training, and little power to enforce the law, Bach patrolled the city each morning on behalf of Echelon Protective Services in his family's minivan without the benefit of lights or a siren, rolling down his window to cajole people into behaving. Bach's previous security job had been at a company that stationed him outside a grocery store as a deterrent to shoplifting and told him to avoid interacting with customers. A human scarecrow was how Bach described that role, so he chose to move to Echelon in 2021 because he wanted to be part of the glue that pieced his hometown back together. Now Bach watched as a man with a massive cut on his forehead wobbled and nearly fell on the sidewalk. "You okay, buddy?" Bach asked. Looks like you're having a rough morning. My name's Michael. What's your name? Name is my name, the man said. He laughed and adjusted a filthy bandage that covered half his face so Bach could see the full extent of his injuries. His nose was split in half. His lips were swollen to twice their size. And a deep gash ran across the center of his forehead. He looked to be no more than about 20, and Bach studied him and thought about his own three teenage stepchildren. He'd married their mother in 2015 after a decade of loneliness, and even beyond his faith, it was his new relationships with his children that had taught him how to build trust by being patient and kind. You got beat up pretty bad, Bach said. I'm an EMT. If you'll sit with me, I'll get you cleaned up. Bach dialed 911. This time it took only a few minutes for an ambulance to arrive. The police officer showed up moments later and signed a temporary mental health hold for John Doe. There were times when it seemed as if all 400 of Echelon's clients were requesting help from the company's 24-hour dispatcher as soon as he got into his minivan. Two guys fighting on the side of our garbage chute, said Red One Alert from a coffee shop. Man threatening people with a dagger, read another from an art gallery. Buffet of misery, fentanyl users passed out all around the apartment building. Bach started driving toward the apartments, but then he saw a medical examiner taping off one of Echelon's properties with crime tape. It was a parking garage, and Bach pulled over and saw a man sprawled on the curb under a blue medical tarp. Oh, no, what happened? Bach asked, even though he already knew. There had been 22 reported overdoses on Portland's public sidewalks in the past 36 hours. It's rinse and repeat at this point, the medical examiner said. Bach scanned the surrounding blocks for more victims because one overdose sometimes indicated that a particularly deadly batch of drugs had arrived on the street. He counted 8 people nodding out in the doorways and 3 more actively smoking fentanyl, including one person with facial wounds Bach recognized from the day before. It was the same John Doe, and he'd been discharged from the hospital back to the street. He had a fentanyl smoking straw in his hand. Bach had revived at least 20 drug users in the past few years, and he always carried 8 doses of naloxone. Jesus juice, his colleagues sometimes called it. But lately, the medication wasn't always enough to reverse an overdose. Synthetic fentanyl had gotten stronger, and it seemed to Bach as if Portland had increased its level of tolerance. He kept walking around the building and nudging people awake until he was back at the parking garage, where the victim's body had already been bagged and taken to the morgue. Bach walked back to his minivan, slammed the door, and called his wife. I'm having a really hard morning, he said. It's too much. It gets worse every week. Then a while later, he checked his phone and saw a new message from an Echelon client, a parking garage. Disturbance, the subject line read, and Bach scanned down to the message. There's a woman trying to take another woman's child. Bach wove through traffic and ran into the garage to join one of his Echelon colleagues, who'd arrived a minute earlier. A boy stood near the wall, shaking and pressed against his mother. That lady tried to take me, he said. He pointed at a woman with no shoes and a tie-dyed shirt who stood across the garage. Hiba Wasif had driven into the city to take her 7-year-old son shopping at Nike, and they were returning to their car when a woman started following them, hissing at the boy, grabbing his hands, and saying she needed to protect him from being abused. She claimed the boy's identity had been switched in a microwave, and he actually belonged to her. The mother held onto her son, ran for her car, and called 911 as the woman chased them into the garage. Thank God you're here, Wasif told the security guards. The problem was that, as guards, they lacked the authority to make an arrest for a crime they hadn't witnessed. Only the police had the power to do that. and they would need both a perpetrator and a victim at the scene in order to make the arrest. That meant the echelon guards had to somehow keep everyone in the garage. Bach approached the perpetrator. "Would you like to sit and talk?" he asked. "It feels like it's easier to get to know someone on the friendly basis." "I'm not your friend. I'm a missing person," she said. She began to tell him about her background, interspersing her delusions with some facts about her life. Her name was Jane Wilder. She was 29. She'd moved to Portland from Arizona after a divorce in 2021, rented an apartment downtown, and started making deliveries for Amazon. She befriended some of the people living in tents near her apartment, and eventually one of them became her boyfriend. They'd started using fentanyl together, and now she'd been living for more than a year on the street, where she'd been arrested, hospitalized, assaulted, and abused. A few minutes later, the boy's father, Ashraf Musa, came running into the garage. "Where are the police?" he shouted. He told Bach he was going to take his family home because his son didn't feel safe in a downtown garage a few dozen feet from his attempted kidnapper. "I get it. I really do," Bach said, "but the police don't have a crime without a victim." Bach dialed a number for the police bureau's central precinct and asked to speak to the sergeant in charge. But the receptionist told him that no one was available and no officers had been dispatched yet. The guard's only option was to continue stalling, so Bach talked to the boy's father while the other guard offered Wilder his phone to make a call, thinking it might calm her down. She dialed an Arizona number to speak to her family, who had spent the past several years trying to get her help. "No, you can't keep trying to control me," Wilder screamed into the phone. She hung up and ran out of the garage. Bach chased after her, the boy's father followed, and several other security guards joined in the pursuit. "What's wrong with all of you?" Wilder shouted as she ran down the middle of the street. "Stop following me." After four more calls to 911, Bach saw officers arrive. He led them over to Wilder, and they followed her into Pioneer Courthouse Square, an urban park downtown. It had taken 1 hour and 6 minutes for police to arrive, but Echelon had managed to deliver them an attempted kidnapping suspect in severe mental distress. And now maybe something good would come of it. Bach looked on as the police officer approached Wilder. "We just want to talk to you," the officer said, but Wilder ran away and jumped into a public fountain. "Stay away from me or I'll hurt somebody," she shouted. "I've been abused. I'll cover this city in blood." The officers huddled together to make a plan for how they could end the spectacle without using force and also without triggering Wilder into more violence or even suicide. "The thing is, I don't have a victim at the moment," the officer told Bach. "We called the family and they basically said they don't want to deal with the police. So if I don't have a crime..." "Okay, you need a crime. I respect that," Bach said. "But where do we stand on a mental health hold?" "It's not worth us getting into a huge fight to take her to the hospital," the officer said. Bach stood there for a few seconds trying to understand how the spectacle of the last 90 minutes could result in nothing. "I appreciate where you're coming from, but you're breaking my heart right now," Bach said. "That's where we're at, as much as it sucks," the officer said. "I'm sorry." "Thank you, I understand," Bach said. He stood in place at the edge of the square and watched as police drove off and Wilder descended from the ledge, disappearing back into the city. This article originally appeared in the New York Times. Here's it's a business column. It says, "Please just bring back the cashiers. The self-checkout lane is broken," said Amanda Mull. When those despicable little kiosks first started popping up across the country, The sales pitch was that checkout lines would disappear. You could scan your stuff, plunk it in a bag, and you're done. But anyone who's been in a grocery store recently knows that's hardly how this process actually goes. You still have to wait in line, only to be bombarded with bleats and flashes when you fail to set a purchase down in the right spot. Then you need to locate the usually lone employee charged with supervising all of the finicky kiosks. It's easy to understand why retailers were seduced by self-checkout. The average four-kiosk setup cost around $125,000. Expensive, yes, but cheaper than employing humans who get sick, ask for raises, want things. But with a skeleton crew left manning the checkout, it's no wonder that shoplifting has skyrocketed. Some retailers have begun hiring back humans to help shoppers or deter thieves. It's a tacit but necessary admission that kiosk technology just isn't good enough to support the level of autonomy that stores wish they could have. Amazon's experimental no-checkout-at-all convenience stores haven't caught on either. Running a supermarket still requires a human touch. Here's a Health and Science article. Seaweed, food of the ancients. Outside of sushi restaurants, seaweed is all but absent from Western diets today. But ancient Europeans once saw aquatic plants as a staple food. In a new study, researchers examined the dental calculus, or tartar, from the remains of 74 individuals found at sites across Europe dating from about 6,400 BC to AD 1100. Of the 37 samples in which they could detect biomarkers for specific foods, 26 contained telltale signs of seaweed and pondweed. These biomarkers came from inside the dental calculus, so it's unequivocal. Co-author Karen Hardy from University of Glasgow tells The Guardian, they couldn't have not chewed it. Earlier research had shown the presence of seaweed at Stone Age sites, but researchers had thought it was used for fuel or fertilizer, not lunch. Hardy hopes the finding will encourage modern humans to think about cooking with seaweed, which is helpful and sustainable to harvest. If we ate it before, she says, we can start eating it again. On the Talking Points page, Biden rating his Israel-Gaza response. Let's just say it. President Biden has done a great job with Israel, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark. Following Hamas' murderous attack, he has given the Jewish state consistent moral, rhetorical, and concrete support. Biden rallied Europe to Israel's cause and spoke movingly to Israelis during a visit to Tel Aviv, declaring, "You are not alone." He also balanced hawkish clarity with hard-headed humanitarianism, deploying two U.S. carrier groups to the region to deter follow-up attacks by Hezbollah and Iran, and persuaded Israel to open an aid corridor into Gaza. The president deserves praise for explaining the deep connections between U.S. support for Israel and for Ukraine, said the New York Post in an editorial. Hamas and Russia both want to completely annihilate a neighboring democracy and overturn the global order, Biden said during an Oval Office speech last week. It's about time he embraced America's role as a global policeman. We just hope more decisive actions follow his words. Biden gave an excellent and statesmanlike speech, said Michael Tomasky in the New Republic. But while it might make political sense to link Israel and Ukraine, Biden is now seeking more aid for both countries in a $105 billion funding request. There are some important differences. Our support for Ukraine has clear-cut objectives: repel the invader and keep as much land under Kyiv's control as possible. The calculus is trickier with Israel. Israel wants to decapitate Hamas, but a long war in Gaza could drag in Hezbollah, Iran, and eventually the U.S. We should all hope Biden is pushing Israel hard to keep this as brief and humane as possible. There's peril for Biden at home, too, Alexander Simon in Slate said. about half of voters under age 35, arguably the most critical demographic constituency for Democrats, disapprove of sending military aid to Israel. A brutal U.S.-backed war in Gaza could alienate the cohort in the run-up to November 2024. For now, there's little evidence of a voter backlash, said David Mark in CNN.com. Three-quarters of Americans believe it's in the country's best interest to support Israel, and Biden has drawn on a close five-decades-long relationship with the Israeli government to manage the crisis. This has allowed him to project a capable and steadfast image and counterclaims that, at 80, he's too old for a second term. The situation in the Middle East is highly volatile, but Biden, for now, is nailing a key part of the job, being presidential. Georgia indictment. Several Trump allies flip. The Kraken has been released on probation, said David A. Graham in The Atlantic. And that's very bad news for President Trump. His former lawyer, Sidney Powell, who once threatened to release the Kraken, a mythical sea beast, to prove the 2020 election was stolen through massive fraud, pleaded guilty last week to six counts of intentional election interference charges in Fulton County, Georgia. She was given a fairly lenient sentence of 6 years of probation and fined nearly $9,000. Powell, one of 19 co-defendants in District Attorney Fannie Willis's racketeering case against President Trump, took part in meetings with Trump as he plotted to maintain power in late 2020. Powell's guilty plea may have triggered the falling domino scenario Willis hoped for, as two other co-defendants who worked with Trump to overturn the election, lawyers Kenneth Cheesbro and Jenna Ellis, quickly followed Powell in pleading guilty. Willis will now be able to draw on testimony from people who were deeply enmeshed in the former president's coup attempt. Powell's prominence in the president's orbit during that period cannot be overstated, said Glenn Kirshner in MSNBC. Claiming that voting machines had been rigged by communist money from Venezuela and China, she urged Trump to order the military to seize the machines. He even proposed naming her special counsel to investigate voter fraud, an idea alarmed Trump aides shot down. Now Powell has admitted the effort to overturn the election was a criminal conspiracy. She's also one of six unindicted co-conspirators in Special Counsel Jack Smith's federal election interference case, and to avoid charges, Powell and friends will now have little choice but to become formal cooperating witnesses. It's highly likely these insiders can provide incriminating evidence against Trump himself. In fact, these witnesses may produce some jaw-dropping testimony, said Kim Well in The Bulwark. They will be asked to describe their conversations with Trump, which could reveal what he knew about the true election results. Powell even took part in a scheme to illegally breach the voting machines and copy data. Now that she has flipped, the Kraken will be released in Trump's direction, said Rex Hupke in USA Today. After Powell's stolen election claims became more and more bizarre, Trump deemed Powell crazy. But it turns out she's sane enough to know when to save her own hide. And a few of the short notes. Faced with rising harassment, death threats, and political criticism, local election officials in swing states are retiring and resigning in high numbers. In Nevada, 11 of 17 counties have election directors who are new since 2020. In Arizona, 12 of 15 counties have lost at least one top election official. And in Pennsylvania, 40 of the state's 67 county election offices have new directors or deputy directors. President Biden has held fewer news conferences at this point in his tenure, 13 solo and 17 joint, than any president since George H.W. Bush. He has also given fewer interviews, 74, than any president since Ronald Reagan. At this stage in his presidency, Donald Trump had held 52 news conferences and given 273 interviews. New York City Mayor Eric Adams has been using voice cloning artificial intelligence to make robocalls to residents in Spanish, Mandarin, Cantonese, Yiddish, and Haitian Creole, languages that Adams does not actually speak. The messages about city events do not include a disclaimer stating that they were generated using AI. On the poll watch, 34% of adults think almost all or most of the cryptocurrency companies are scams, while 14% say most or all of them are legitimate. Just 14% of Americans own cryptocurrency, and 10% used to own it. And we'll finish up today with a couple of quotes. Alexander Solzhenitsyn says, "The line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being." And Jackie Gleason says, "The second day of a diet is always easier than the first. By the second day, you're off it." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. It's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.